Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Brent Simmons. You're listening to Core Intuition, the guarantee of free speech.
All right, folks, we have a very special show this week. We have not had a lot of guests on the show over the many, many years that Manton and I have been doing Core Intuition. I think, Manton, it was just Wolf Wrench,
mm-hmm.
Craig Hockenberry.
And that's it.
And that's it. And
just
we always thought, oh, we should have guests. That would be a good idea. And then, of course, our technical, it's kind of weird to admit being technically incompetent, because that's sort of the premise of our show, that we are technical people. But when it comes to podcasting, we barely squeak by. So we have been talking about having our guest this week, Mr. Brent Simmons, on the show for a long, long time. And of course, my friendship with Brent goes back a long time. I met Brent in person after, of course, being familiar with his work, owning software that he had written. I met him at the first C4, speaking of Wolf Wrench. I guess that was 2006, I think. And of course, meeting Brent at C4 planted the seed of a friendship with us that ultimately led to me acquiring Mars Edit from NewsGator, the company he was working for, when I acquired it. And I've become good friends with Brent over the years. Of course, we share a lot of values. The reason Manton and I do this show together is we share values. I think this is a big three-way value-sharing session. not to get too crazy. But anyway, make a long story short, Brent Simmons, welcome to Core Intuition.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm always listening to Core Intuition thinking, those guys really share my values.
We should have a three-way value session.
We totally should. But the thing is, that's actually true. Oh, thanks. Thank you very much. And, you know, I've known Manton even longer than I've known Daniel by quite a while. Perhaps it took a while to meet in person, but we knew each other online going back to the mid-90s, I think.
Yeah, back in the old frontier days, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's you know, you just said, I think, Daniel, I think you said C4 like 2004. Is that what you said?
I said it's 2006. I know it was
2006. Yeah. Well, still, it seemed like a really long time ago. And then, saying the late 90s is just, I don't know, it feels like a lifetime ago. But at the same time, I don't know, it's kind of, some of that's still fresh in my mind a little bit.
Yeah, mine too. Well, you know, a lot of those themes are still themes today.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of things we worked on then, I mean, you know, a lot of technology has changed, the world has changed, but a lot of the things we care about and work on are still the exact same stuff.
You know, some things kind of, they come back around. And like lately I've been like fascinated with blogging again and microblogging and stuff and RSS. And that's right out of that era, right? That's right out of like the work you were doing and Dave Weiner was doing back in the day. And yeah, it's, you know, we kind of get distracted with different services and different apps, and then some things come back, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
You guys, obviously, you go way back. I was kind of a newbie to all this, and it's been kind of interesting for me. When I say all this, I mean like you guys have a particular connection to the early days of blogging. And for me, it was like, I can remember the first time I set up like a Blossom blog, probably in 2004 or so, which was already pretty late. And that's obviously like, you know, I think 5 years after you guys were digging into things. So, or maybe more, right? I don't know. That's like the Bible or something. It's like there's 1 year ago, there's 5 years ago, and then there's like Bible times ago.
That's right. So back during the Old Testament days when Manton and I were doing this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good times. I like, Brent, you've had several posts, even recently you've had some posts on your blog about kind of, you know, revisiting the old days. And I love that stuff because, well, first of all, I said it feels like yesterday, but truth is I can't remember half that stuff. And yeah, so indeed, Actually writing it down is really nice. And that's actually one thing I loved about, you know, your podcast you did, The Record, with Chris Parrish over the last year or so, is getting, I mean, it didn't go back to that era exactly, but getting those stories out So that we have, like, while we can actually remember how to tell the stories, actually get them down.
Yeah, it'd be tragic to lose everything. And, you know, there's already so much that's forgotten now, but we still have a chance to remember a great deal of it. And I just have the feeling that people from the future will look back and wish they had a record of all this stuff. And so whatever ways we can use to make sure that happens is a good thing, whether that's through podcasts, blogs, books, whatever. But that's all a good thing to do.
And one of the premises, I think, of the record is that you started with this particular time frame in mind of Seattle before, what was it, Seattle before the iPhone, right? Was the premise. And am I right that that was sort of, that you're looking forward to covering other periods of time?
I think we'll do Seattle after the iPhone.
Seattle next. After the iPhone.
Yeah. Next. And and it's easy to start with our own geography because Seattle has such a huge development community here. And we've done all of our interviews in person, and this way we don't actually have to fly somewhere and do interviews. You know, we could do them all right here. In fact, we could just do, and I've thought about this, do a Seattle podcast, like a weekly thing forever and not run out of people.
Of course. Yeah. You could do like Seattle in the macOS 9 classic days.
Yeah. Right.
And it would be like, what now software and stuff, right? Would they? No, that was Portland.
Oh, it was Portland. But John Chafee and his program partner
busy,
are both
busy
from,
back, right?
Yeah. Right. And they're here on Bainbridge Island. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much going on in Portland. It's like, I mean, not in Portland. Sorry. You know, there is so much going on. There is so much going on in Portland. And that's a separate show. But there's so much going on in Seattle. And it's one of those cities where I often feel like, damn it, like, why is everything going on in Seattle when ostensibly I live in like kind of a bigger place? When I lived in San Francisco, it was like kind of a bigger place. I guess I've always lived in kind of bigger places than Seattle, but it seems totally outweighed for the size of Seattle that it has so much going on. And it has so much going on in so many different dimensions. It's like, it has obviously its huge music reputation.
Yeah.
And then it has like in the Mac and like, tech, it's funny that it has so much going on in the Mac, like Apple realm, when it's of course more known for being the center of Microsoft's universe.
And Amazon too.
Oh, and Amazon, of course.
Yeah, right. We got two big ones right here. Yeah.
And then of course still it's still Jet City.
Yes.
And so much going on. I listen to other podcasts, coming out of Seattle, like Roderick on the Line with Merlin Mann and John Roderick. And it's like, I get a different view of Seattle. And I'm thinking, geez, this is just one of many facets of Seattle. And I'm always thinking, oh man, you know, Glenn Fleischman's there. He's got his other angle on it. So much going on. Is just like being in Seattle. How does it feel to you, Brent? Is it like a nonstop, I'm always finding something new to do? Or do you find it just kind of just like, find your little niche in it and live a more normal life?
Well, you know, I do live a pretty normal life. In fact, I took the trash out right before coming onto this podcast. And I made a salad for dinner. I actually cut the lettuce and did all those things.
You can do that in Seattle?
I totally can.
You didn't have it artisanally made and delivered by...
I'm a lettuce artisan.
Okay, good. It was actually, artisanally made.
Yes, it was. Actually, I'm better with the tomatoes. That's where I really shine, tomatoes. So what I like about Seattle is there's a great development community here, particularly Mac and iOS, and that's the community I know. But it's also not as big as San Francisco. In San Francisco, I think it's easy to get distracted. You could be out at something every single night. And maybe you could in Seattle if you tried really hard, but it doesn't have that kind of that overwhelming social scene that San Francisco has. So we have plenty of time to, you know, it rains and we go inside and we play guitars and work on our software. And that's how Seattle is able to punch above its weight because we have a great work ethic. And frankly, the weather isn't always so nice out. So, you know, we're indoors in front of the computers and such.
Well, speaking of being indoors and in front of computers, of course, since I've known you, you have been indoors in your home office in Ballard, right? Ballard neighborhood of Seattle. And huge, huge news. We covered it, of course, on Core Intuition a few weeks ago. The bombshell was dropped that you, the one of the centerpieces of Mac and iOS indie development, had left your indie, not left, sorry, you augmented your indie life by taking a full-time job at the Omni Group. And it seemed at once like, hold on, Brent Simmons, he's that indie guy. He's not supposed to have a full-time job. But also, mm-hmm. also, of course he's going to Omni, because Omni is awesome, and they... Speaking of shared values, it feels like a shared value situation to me. Like, I've always felt very much that way about Omni, even though they are an increasingly large indie company. What is it, like 50, 60 employees now?
I think just hit 60, yeah.
60, yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty big company.
Which means they're smaller than Black Pixel, but right, bigger than almost everybody else.
Nobody, yeah. Nobody's bigger than Black Pixels. It's like Apple, Black Pixel, everybody else.
That's a lot, though. And it, like, you know, we talked to, you said, you know, indie, and then I think Dan even said like indie company in there. And it reminds me, like, you were talking about C4 and Jonathan Wolf French had a talk where he was talking about like what is indie, and his, correct me if my memory is wrong here, but his thing was like non-large is how you define it. And so Omni would still be in that category. They have a lot of people, but it's still not large in the sense of a big software company.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have VC funding, right? It's grown very, very slowly over 20 plus years.
Yeah.
You know, and it has no business attachment to any other larger company. It's, you know, it's just a profitable business that's still small enough that everybody knows everybody, and, you know, decisions are made by people talking to each other rather than, you know, giant bureaucracies and so on. And everybody pulls their weight, and everybody there is awesome.
That's great. It seems like this is still the size where you can make it work, and it feels like the right kind of environment. Once you get like 100 or more, that's like, I don't know, that seems like the line of where, I don't know, there's too much management and too much bureaucracy where it's difficult for folks like us to be, you know, to feel like we're really fitting in.
Sure. Indie's management is extremely flat. It's I'm not sure we actually have any managers.
You just called it indie.
That sums up how he feels about it.
You just called it indie software.
He's renamed Omni.
Yeah, Indie Software Group.
That works.
But I like it, yeah. Tell me, though, Brent, how has it felt to... I assume you're actually going into the office and working.
I am, yeah. They're one of the rare companies like this that actually says, yeah, everyone's going to work here. Yeah.
Well, I like taking a stand like that, mm-hmm. but it obviously means a big change for you, because this, I think, the very first time you've ever worked in a software job where you were expected to leave your house. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I've never worked where other people could see me. it's very strange. But you know, I'm not one of those guys who like rebels against any form of structure or something. You know, I like getting up at the same time and eating the same breakfast every day. And so now I'm taking the same bus trip every day too, and going to the same place every day. And it's kind of fun. It's different. You know, but I like it. One thing I like about it is that it does, for the first time in my career, give me a real dividing line between work and not work, which is interesting. I mean, you know, I've had a few weekends now, and they are like literally the first weekends I feel like I've had as an adult, practically, which is like a whole new discovery. What is this, Sunday? Well, watch football and just hang out? Oh, okay. You know, that's kind of new to me, and I'm really enjoying that. You know, it turns out I don't have to work like 70 hours a week every single week to have a good life. In fact, probably better off not working that way.
That's what they say anyway.
Yeah, you know, if you ever get the chance to find out, I recommend it.
Well, but the other thing is, I think it sounds like a cool like relationship you have with Omni is, of course, you get to keep working on your stuff with QBranch.
Yeah.
And that runs the risk, of course, of pushing your hourly workload up again if you decide to indulge in it that much. Has that been a concern so far, that like you said, you've enjoyed having your first weekend off? is it, do you think it'll just go in waves where you're like, okay, well, sometimes I'm working on a ton on QBranch stuff and my weekends are kind of taken up by that. And other times you'll be like, okay, well, time to take a little break from that and actually have some weekends.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll come in waves and different weekends will be different. And I'm working on it in the evenings and stuff. But it's a little bit different, not looking at Vesper as the thing I really need to hurry up and do, because otherwise, I don't have very much money.
Right.
I was looking at it that way, and now I'm not. Now I'm looking at it as, hey, this is a fun thing. I love working with these guys. I love the software. I have the luxury of being able to apply my best engineering care to this piece of software. And so, you could say, well, that makes it a hobby. Well, okay, fine. It's a very serious hobby, but it's a hobby that I can now enjoy without feeling any, stress connected to it, which makes a huge difference. Because if I wasn't doing that, it would be some other piece of software, or might be making music or something. But, I'd be spending my time on something. I wouldn't just be vegging in front of the couch. Never been a video game player, so that's out.
It seems like the timing was right, because Vesper is, like if you had stopped and gone to Omni in the middle of the syncing work or something, that might have been more stressful. It seems like, you wrapped up a bunch of stuff. It's kind of, I don't know, it's mature for the point it's at. And I assume that's from the outside looking in, that's what it feels like. It's not like you're having to scramble and fix all sorts of bugs and add new features like every week. So it's at a good place.
Yeah. The heavy lifting's all been done, right? I mean, I have all the client syncing code and data model and everything, that's all shared with the Mac version. And of course the online component was huge, and that's working so great. I never pay any attention to it. It just comes right along. I don't think I've committed a single change in like 2 months at least. Haven't had to.
Do you need to check on the servers or anything like that? Or does it just,
I barely even check. Every time I do, it's like, everything's great. It's just,
you're making Manson cry here. I can hear him crying from Austin.
I've obviously done something wrong. It seems like sometimes it's a daily chore. Like, oh my God, I got SSH into something and fix something.
Yeah. So. Well, so I went really high level, right? I went with mobile services. So, there's just a whole bunch of stuff I don't have to deal with. There's nothing I can SSH into, as a matter of fact, right? So that whole level of administration, everything is just, it's somebody else's headache, and they keep it running great. So my whole job was just to make sure I wrote really good code, and I took my time. It took at least 6 months, I think, to produce 2,000 lines of JavaScript. That sounds really, really slow, but I was new to it, hadn't done server-side work in 10 years. So
yeah.
I just wrote and then rewrote and tested and refigured and just kept at it until, I was still very nervous on day one, but somewhat optimistic that I had nailed it, just because I had spent so much time. And in fact, I had. So, phew.
That's great. That's really good to hear.
That's a super good feeling.
And JavaScript, I think it would take me even, I don't know. My JavaScript coding skills are actually, they haven't progressed that much since the late 90s, what we were talking about. I still code some stuff as if it was that long ago. So I'm getting better.
Well, I got to say, my syncing code, if you looked at it, you would say, oh, that's kindergarten code. But that's very deliberate, right? Because that way I can like come back to it later and understand it. And not do anything in the least tiny bit clever. It's hugely straightforward.
Yeah. And that's, you mentioned the lines of code, but this is something I know you've written about before, and this actually took me a long time to figure out, but that less code is actually almost always better and more bug-free than a whole bunch of clever code, or just a whole bunch of code in general. Easier to debug, less code. Usually it's faster, even if you don't optimize it. It's just less code to run.
Mm-hmm. I ran across a small instance of this in some Mac app code. There's a table view that has some little, not technically accessory views, but something like that. And they hide and show depending on some counter, right? And the code I was looking at actually removed those subviews from the hierarchy, milled them out, released them, got rid of them, and then recreated them as needed. But it took more code to do that than to just set the hidden flag on those. And once I had decided to do that, I could delete a good dozen lines of code, and I fixed, and it happened to fix this other bug with auto layout constraints, holding on to some views that had gone away, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, less code, more simple, you know, missing some weird micro-optimization someone had written, but, you know, no one will ever notice a difference, and it's just going to work better. I love stuff like that.
When you opt into Apple's, you know, when you, basically what you're saying is like set hidden or whatever. You say, I'm going to take Apple's way of doing this. And sometimes that gets you in a bind because they don't cover your edge cases. But often it means you just get to benefit from what some crazy nerds in Cupertino optimized on your behalf. And
yeah.
It's almost always going to be better than what, you know, you or I or Manton, because we're just a bunch of dummies who have shared values.
But what do we know?
It's going to be better than our, you know, optimization, because there's just so much more importance attached to, you know, like the app kit or the UI kit team getting something right. So
yeah.
When you can reduce code and go with what Cupertino has to offer, it's obviously a good idea.
Yeah. And then, of course, when you do find a bug, you tear your hair out. I found one today that I just... I don't know what to do sometimes.
Right.
I mean, I'm not even sure if when it's working, if it's working by coincidence and I'm just totally down the wrong path entirely. I don't know.
Yeah.
There are those times.
So are you working now actively still on the Vesper Mac client? Is that sort of sidelined a little bit with your Omni, you know, debut, or is that like, you said you had a nice weekend, but are your nights taken up with this stuff, or how's that working?
Yeah, most nights I work on Vesper. I'm working on Vesper for Mac, also doing some iOS stuff. I mean, now we have size classes, and Vesper was never auto layout, and I think it's time that it becomes an auto layout app, because you know, we got these new phones and, yeah,
that's going to be another 6 months
and all this stuff. Yeah, right. No doubt. You know, I've got a good start on it, but you know, there's a lot to do there. So I it's not like it's an old app, but it's already not modern in certain respects, because it was written for iOS 6, and I hate getting behind on that stuff. I really just can't stand it. Because it, you know, leads to something I just don't even want to touch. You know, so I have to. Yeah, I consider that technical debt, and I just try to pay it off as quickly as I can. So there's that too. And, you know, maybe a couple other little sideliney things too I like to work on. We'll see.
You went to iOS 7 pretty quick with Vesper, though, requiring it, right? Like almost right away?
Mm-hmm. I think we were maybe a few days or a week after the actual iOS 7 release. And we're requiring iOS 8 now.
And we went
really
already?
Quickly. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well. Yeah. So we had the basic support for the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus just by throwing in the correct launch images. And I think I had hard coded 320 points wide in a couple places and just fixed those. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done anything like, you know, iPhone 6 Plus in landscape gives you like, well, you can do like a split view or something there. So, well, Do we want to do that kind of thing? And, you know, if so, suddenly do I have to now switch to using storyboards and auto layout and all this kind of crazy stuff? Maybe I probably do. Yeah, it is a slippery slope. But
especially once you do a landscape split view for the iPhone 6 Plus, it's just, you can just see the iPad version just over, you know, just a little bit further away. And it's like, you know, it's like you almost have to go all the way once you take that step, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm trying not to spend too much time thinking about that and just like concentrating on actually, you know, doing this stuff right. But yeah, I understand it. You know, an iPad version can almost accidentally fall out of this work.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to be working on the Mac version.
Are you still with the Mac version? Are you still thinking Swift? Or are you...
You know, I go and I do some Swift, and then I run into something that's like kind of hard in Swift. And maybe it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm like, you know, I know that's doable, this thing, but now I have to go look up, you know, something and I'm just not in the mood and I set it aside and come back the next day and go, ah, screw it. I like Objective-C.
Right. Yeah, it feels like there's a little pushback lately against, I mean, you know, we're all negative and like, yeah, we don't like our new language from the beginning, but a lot of people jumped into it and then they kind of pulled back a little bit, it seems like.
It's still such a moving target. I mean, I read the release notes, you know, all the time with each release. And I'm like, oh, that changed and that and that. And I'm like, wow, I don't really want to be rewriting my code, you know, too often.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I hate to say it, but I've been gratified over the years by being a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to Apple technologies. And people are laughing, I'm sure, right now. There's a limit to this, the fact that I haven't shipped anything for iOS and so many years.
That's really paid off for you.
That's really paid off for me. But, you know, a lot of other things were like, oh, man, when people were fretting and fuming about core data bugs when they were coming through. And I was like, yep, never touched it, never needed it. And obviously this has its limits, but I sort of feel like Swift right now is a classic case of like, if you can afford the time to really ride the bumps of that road, you know, if you can really get in there and like, you're basically gonna, I think if you start learning, Swift today, that's great. I'm trying to learn Swift today. But if you try to become an expert in Swift today, then by the time Swift is more mainstream, you're going to have become an expert in two languages. You're going to become an expert in Swift that is mainstream and all of the Swift that's no longer even used, right? Because it's like past versions of Swift. Mm-hmm. And there's, and not to say that that's a bad thing, but I don't know. I have a hard time priority. It's kind of like, well, you know, if you were like learning springs and struts and you knew like a year from now, springs and struts are going to be gone and we're going to be using auto layout. I don't know. That's a bad analogy, bad comparison. But it's, the idea is just that like, well, don't invest too much energy into this thing that you know is about to go away. I kind of feel like there's something to that. I don't mean Swift's going away. I mean that it's going to evolve. Maybe I'm underestimating or overestimating now how much it's going to evolve still, but I'm still in that mood where I'm like, I don't know. And I remember, Brent, when it first came out, I really attached to your take on it, which was, this is a new language that's going to influence so much of what we do in the years to come, decades to come, possibly. It's only pragmatic to get in there and start using it so you can report bugs and give feedback and help dictate how the language evolves. And I liked that a lot. I thought, that's good. Yeah, I should get in there and do that too. And then a few days into it, I was like, you know, this is really hard for me to get through. Maybe I'm the kind of person who should just let like people like Colin Barrett do this.
Sure. Yeah.
And I kick back and wait until there's a nice, you know, ready-made language for me to use.
Mm-hmm.
And has your opinion on that front changed at all? Do you feel like you still want to be at the forefront as far as like shaping the language is concerned, or does that seem like, does that still seem like something you're passionate about, or is it less so?
I think I would have liked to have been able to do that, but for one thing, I was just super busy this summer.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Swift is really hard. It is. Objective-C is really easy in comparison to Swift. And what I found is, you know, I read a ton on the Apple Dev forums and on blogs and everything. And it was difficult at times to understand what people were actually writing about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, you know, this is just not easy. So I didn't even have enough time necessarily to understand people's points, much less to develop my own develop my own point of view on a lot of the questions. So I realized, you know, there was just no way I wasn't going to be able to do that. And that was kind of a shame. But on the other hand, I'm like, well, it looks like there are a whole lot of really smart and thoughtful people working on this. So I'm going to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. It's a shame there's not, I mean, it's a shame and it's good that there's not like one thing that Swift brings that just leapfrogs you above everything else. Like when Coco like was the preferred, you know, became the best way to build Mac apps, you know, back, let's rewind the clock a little bit back to NetNewsWire and all that stuff. It's like you had done some Carbon stuff, Frontier Kernel, whatever. When you went to do, you know, a Mac app, you're like, Cocoa is the way to do it because you get some great stuff out of the box. You know, Swift doesn't really have that, unfortunately, and fortunately, because we don't want to be forced to use it. But at the same time, there's not that one thing where you could say, yeah, if I just switch to this, my users are going to be happier because whatever. There's nothing right. like that there.
And isn't that, on one hand, a great testament to Cocoa? The frameworks are so much more important than the language. And, mm-hmm. and the frameworks are still fantastic. On the other hand, though, maybe those frameworks are due for something somewhere down the road. But, yeah. you know, because things could be a lot easier. I mean, whenever I'm doing something like, I've done this before, this is repetitive, this is, you know, not a great use of my time, you know, which comes up for every programmer, right? I just wonder why I'm still having to do those things. So, you know, maybe right. at some point the frameworks will be replaced. I can't imagine, you know, but it's not my job to figure out how. But it's also possible that when those frameworks are replaced with some newer paradigm, that we'll see that it was necessary to have Swift in place first.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Don't know, though. Just guessing. No idea.
And I think one of the sort of conundrums with Swift is that it is presented as both making far more complicated things possible and making Mac and iOS development far more accessible. You know, like you look at Apple's latest, they put up a bunch of PR stuff with Yosemite. And one of the things, they put up a whole PR page for Swift, and it's like, finally, a language that invites, you know, people, you know, for all kinds of people to come develop for the Mac and iOS. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, like, well, these are not Colin Barrett people. These are like, you know, these are not people who are like, oh, finally I can do my higher order, you know, method calls and,
right.
and you know, I can finally do like Haskell like programming on the Mac, whatever, all this stuff that's just a little bit blurry to me still, obviously, by the way I'm describing it. They're showing like, you know, this is like, you know, the JavaScript generation is finally mm-hmm. going to be encouraged to check out the Mac and iOS and they'll be comfortable with it. And I'm thinking like, you know, I can actually see that. I see that it is, you know, being like safer with regard to memory, having like some, you know, more like shorthand, syntactic shorthand to make things that easier to do. That's one thing. And on the other hand, it's like, I often feel like when I'm starting to look at something with Swift, I'm like, I guess I feel the challenge of like, don't do this like an Objective-C programmer who just got Swift, dummy. You got to like learn how to use all these fancy new features. And obviously I don't have to use all those fancy new features. And that's not how Apple's selling it to the general programmer public. But there's a little bit of a rift there, I think, because maybe it's partly because in the world we all live in, us, you know, the three of us, we are exposed to these super like programmer genius brains who are like, this is how you make a domain specific language with Swift. And I'm like, oh, I don't know how to do that. I don't want to do that. Like,
right.
they're like, and maybe that's just the exposure where it's like, just because you can do it with the language doesn't mean, you know, I kind of feel like, well, I guess I better not start learning Swift until I figure out how the heck you make a domain specific language with it. And on the other hand, Apple's saying, hey, this is a great new language that makes it so anybody can program the Mac and iOS. And I'm like, I want to be in that camp. I want to be in the camp that says, yeah, I can just do this and it's fun and easy. But I guess part of this challenge of transitioning from where we are is like finding a comfortable road that says, hey, yeah, I can take advantage of the nice new features of this without feeling like I have to also take advantage of all the superpower features.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think it's making it more accessible to a whole bunch of new people. I met up with an old friend of mine a few weeks ago, and he had never done, you know, iPhone development or Mac development or whatever, but he's did like web development and PHP and JavaScript or whatever. And so he sees Swift and he's like, this was made for me. Now I can finally jump in and I can learn this stuff without having to worry about C and everything else that I never learned. And so, and for someone like that, I would totally recommend they jump in with Swift from the start. You know, you're starting from nothing, or nothing in terms of the iPhone side of things and the Mac side of things. Jump in with Swift, and you skip the whole. I mean, we all saw like when people were, you know, moving to the platform and learning iPhone development in the early days of the App Store craziness, people would come in and they wouldn't know C, and that would be a real like struggle because they could do a lot. You know, they could get by and ship apps, and they had memory leaks and they had problems. But at some point they start hitting these, okay, now I've really got to learn C, and I've got to learn memory management. I've got to learn, you know, whatever core foundation, whatever these C-based APIs are. And it just takes a lot longer, and they wouldn't really have that problem if they started today.
But, you know, some of those people who are looking at Swift and saying, oh, that kind of looks like the JavaScript or Ruby or something I'm used to, then they're going to find that, oh, actually, there is a type system under the hood, and even though it's doing type inference, you still have to be aware of that. You have to be aware of optionals. You know, there's generics. You know, there's just a lot of stuff there. There's a lot of stuff that's not in, you know, JavaScript or Ruby or PHP. And you know, if they run across some of the same articles on the web that I've been reading, they're going to go, "Okay, no, this is crazy. It's way over my head."
Yeah, you're right. Swift tries to be like a couple things all at once. And depending on how you approach it, I don't know, it either clicks or it doesn't. Yeah, if you stumble upon the wrong Swift article when you're just learning, you might be scared off in a big way.
And the other aspect of that is that it lends itself to being a write-only language, depending on who's doing the writing, right? So like that's an example where, you know, for the most part, people who write Objective-C code, they don't have the tools, they don't have the language tools to write code that you can't kind of unwind and figure out what it's doing. And with Swift, I guess all these powerful features, they do give you the, you know, it's like the whole like obfuscated challenge, right? The obfuscated programming challenges. Boy, that Swift is a gift to those folks, right?
That's true. Operator overloading alone will do wonders for that. Yeah.
But then the other stuff, like you said, like the kind of like nuanced type system, and boy, it could be a challenge, I guess. But hey, it's the brave new world, right? We're supposed to be happy. And I guess
it's mandatory. It's mandatory.
We must be happy. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's be happy about it. Move on. Well, folks, we are very happy to have back as sponsors this week our friends at Crashlytics. Of course, you know, if you've listened to the show before or if you are at all aware of the iOS and Mac developer scene, that Crashlytics is a crash reporting framework that makes it really easy to drop a framework into your app. You download this helper tool from crashlytics.com, and it guides you through the process of dropping a framework into your Xcode project. You build, you release a new build, you upload it to Apple, they ship it. Next time you have crashes, Crashlytics is there fielding those crash reports and making them available to you on crashlytics.com. You can go browse them with this beautiful interface, browse the crashes, see how frequently they're happening, see what platforms they're affecting, see what versions of the OS they're affecting, and then you see this beautiful stack trace of the crash, hopefully figure out what's going on, fix it, and so the next time you ship an update, you will see fewer, or if you're lucky, none of those reports coming through. Of course, Crashlytics also has expanded their offerings, so they offer other things now like beta testing and analytics services. They are just becoming, they started as and are becoming even more of a very developer-centric company. It's, of course, now part of Twitter. They have big support from Twitter to keep doing what they're doing. And, of course, we really appreciate them sponsoring the show here. And if you appreciate that, give them a shout at Crashlytics on Twitter. Let them know you appreciate it. And if you haven't tried it out yet, go to www.crashlytics.com. Download their, like I said, this download for Crashlytics makes it really easy to walk you through the process of setting it up with your project. You won't be committed to it or anything. It'll just show you how easy it is to get it set up with your project, build a release. Then, you know, you decide, you upload it to Apple. Next time you have people run that and they run into any issue, you will find out about it really pronto. So thanks again. And folks, you can learn more at Crashlytics.com.
Yeah, I've been using Crashlytics in my apps, and you know, it's been really great. And you know, a while back on the show, I signed into the website for the first time since they had the answers part of Crashlytics, and it shows you all sorts of stats about your active users and the session length. And one of the things I was fascinated with was this crash-free users, and I was ashamed that it was low. It was not good. I can't remember what it was, but it was in the, like, I don't know, 80s, 80%, something like that. And I felt I can do better. So I've been fixing bugs. I'm happy to say lately, right now, it's 100% crash-free users. So that means everybody that was running my app today, no one crashed. That's how I interpret it. And of course, it fluctuates a little bit, like, but it's been in the, you know, high 90s to 100 lately. And so I feel good about that. I would have no idea if it wasn't for Crashlytics that I was having some good days where people weren't crashing. So thanks, Crashlytics, for sponsoring the show. It's been great to have you guys as a long-term sponsor. Everybody check them out, Crashlytics.com.
I was thinking about how the themes of my career after so many years start to become identifiable. And one of them is treating the internet as the, for the first time in human history, as our guarantee of freedom of speech.
Yeah.
And I know it's not quite the guarantee. In fact, kind of the point is, it might not be, and we could lose it, right? But it is the closest thing by far that we've ever come to a universal guarantee of freedom of speech, not just for the people who own the presses, because it is so cheap and easy to get, you know, your speech up on the web, that a universal guarantee of freedom of speech.
I like it.
One of the reasons I was happy to get invited to come on Core Intuition, because it seems like both of you guys feel very, very much the way I do. I mean, Daniel, you make a blogging tool after all. And Manton, of course, you know, quit Twitter and is into, you know, micro blogs and RSS and all that kind of stuff. And like the old web, where I feel like more people saw the web as what I was talking about, as a unique and an amazing invention in human history, a thing that can bring, you know, the 6 billion voices out into the open to tell their stories and say what they're going to say. That this thing is really something special, and it's something, and it shouldn't just be treated as a way for, you know, monetizing eyeballs and figuring out great new advances in interstitial ads, you know, that kind of stuff actually, you know, I understand the needs for some of that. Everyone needs money. I have to pay my mortgage too, but you know, we can't lose sight of the opportunity that this is. And if the story really is that the web exploded in the early mid 90s and became a wonderful thing and then stopped being that wonderful thing, you know, a little more than 20 years later, then I couldn't even bear that heartbreak. I couldn't be able to stand that. And so one of the themes of my career has just been trying to make sure we keep it and keep fanning those flames. And so I'm very glad every week to listen to you guys, because you often talk about this without putting it maybe in quite the exact same terms I do, but you're talking about this particular theme.
It's true that, like, when you think about your apps too, it's like there's a theme there of like just writing and publishing on almost every one of them, whether it was like Manila back in the day, right? Or yep. NetNewsWire Mars Edit obviously had a huge, you know, writing, publishing component, web component. Glassboard, same thing. Vesper, right? It's all, it seems very, very, and I love that it's over such a long period of time, you can kind of see the themes and trends. And that is, I don't know if you ever thought about that consciously, like through the years, but I think, well, actually, I should ask, did you think about that until recently, that there's that theme, or just did it just kind of happen?
You know, I've never tried to guide what I do based on some ideology, but I've, you know, over the years realized, you know, everything I do has to do with words.
Right.
And then I think to myself, well, no big surprise. When I was a kid, I wanted to grow up to be a writer. And so that's But it's not just that I wanted to be grow up and become a writer. It's also a strong part of me that's highly egalitarian and that believes intensely strongly in freedom, and that there's a value in not just me being a writer, but like everybody being a writer to a certain extent, at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that everyone's going to be Hemingway, but that everybody's got stories, right? You know,
great writers could come from anywhere too, and you need to have. I don't know. We need to encourage people to write more. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I like that we can see the themes there. And I've actually tried to, with my little, you know, business Riverfold, I had at the beginning, I was just kind of like, oh, I was doing apps here and whatever. I didn't really have a lot of focus and kind of clear path. And at some point a couple years ago, I killed off one of my products and I thought, you know, I had too many products and I tried to think about, well, is there a theme here? Is there something? And I came up with something. I'm sure I blogged about this specifically. That yes, the theme is like curation and writing and, you know, archiving stuff. You know, like kind of the flip side to writing, of like actually keeping that stuff around. And so That's actually really helped me plan products and features in the back of my head, knowing there is kind of a theme there, and I'm trying to. Because, you know, we could build anything, but actually having kind of a focus on what we're trying to do as a bigger, kind of bigger picture is really, I don't know, it's really helped me. So I don't know if I'll ever get to actually accomplishing the bigger parts of that theme. But
well, we're all just part of a bigger whole, right? I mean, and so we just do what we could do and hope that adds up to something, I think. But I love that, you know, curation and everything is very close to writing, because it's all about memory and preserving valuable things,
yeah,
in whatever way. Yeah.
So where does all this end up? Like, I mean, we can't predict the tech future far, but like you've been blogging forever, and how do we get from where we are now, where there is, people are starting to pay more attention to blogging and it does feel like there's a little more momentum behind that. But how do we get, this is a super hard question to answer, but how do we get to the point where this stuff, the stuff that I think is really important, like stuff you've written on your site, you know, lasts for a long time. And you know, it's, and other people are thinking about that. Like, I'm writing something that's going to last for a long time. Cause I feel like so much of what people put on the internet, they don't think or care that it might be gone tomorrow. And so they don't, you know, it's kind of like having good backups, but at a much larger scale, because it's the web. And, you know, just actually at the end of this week, as we record, TwitPic, is going down, and every photo that you posted to TwitPic to Twitter over the years, before Twitter rolled their own, is going to be gone, right? And so that's just, right. We have examples of like that every once in a while. That I don't know, to me, they kind of like open my eyes and say, "Well, we can't keep doing this to ourselves." You know, there was probably a lot of really interesting photos posted to that, and they're not going to be. You know, all those links are going to be broken now.
Yeah. I think one of the things is a growing consciousness that trusting your valuable stuff to companies that aren't necessarily going to be around in a year is not a good idea. And maybe people are starting to realize that they need to be aware of and think about that issue.
Yeah.
But I think it happens. It's like one light bulb at a time.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because we're sort of like, you were sort of nostalgic, I think, thinking about like both you and Manton thinking about like the early days of blogging and some of the old, you know, lately there's been this trend to be a little nostalgic about like the old ways of really owning your own blog and the ways that they were interconnected with trackbacks and commenting on blogs was more popular. And somewhat ironically, nowadays, it's like 100 million times easier and cheaper to own your own content, right? Mm-hmm. Like back then, it was a lot harder. Like the nerds could easily do it, but it was a lot harder to say, like, oh, okay, this random Joe Blow is going to start a blog and own all of the content. That can actually happen really easily nowadays because it's so easy to own your own domain name. And back in the day, of course, the farther you go back, the more expensive and more technical prowess you had to have to own that. And yet, in this current atmosphere we're living in, it's easier than ever to own your own content and to own your own domain name. But probably more than ever, it's more popular to surrender that content to a sort of massive hosted service.
Sure, yeah. Or you know, to not blog at all and just post on Facebook and Twitter, or whatever.
Yeah.
Right, because as easy it is easier to blog now, but it's even easier to tweet. Or you know, it's like blogging got easier, but then we have these other forms of writing that are even easier than blogging, because that's something Twitter did get right for all their faults. It's like it's super easy to post a tweet. You don't even have to overthink it because it's so short. You can't go wrong. But I'm curious with the domain name thing. This is something I'm fascinated by because I have no power to fix this problem. But as easy as it is to register a domain name and map it to a WordPress.com blog or Tumblr or something that's super easy to like click once and get set up, the domain name system is still kind of weird and clunky. And you know, you have to do things like renew your domain name, and you know, you sometimes have to mess with, you know, your CNAME records and, you know, whatever. Like, it still is kind of geeky and technical. And it feels like eventually, for the good of the web, like, domain names should be easier. They should last forever. They should be easier to register. They should be easier to transfer. Transferring domain names is still, I think, kind of clunky.
Yeah, I did a transfer earlier this year, and it wasn't as bad as it used to be. The previous time I had done it, I actually had to go to a notary public and fax some documents and stuff. So that part's gotten easier. And yeah,
that's good.
The old days when network solutions was the only game in town. Now that was a nightmare, but things have improved. But yeah, yeah. See, you know, it's not that hard. I mean, people manage the details of their lives fairly well, like more complicated things. They enroll in health insurance and whatever. You know, that's domain true. Names and stuff are not nearly as hard as all those things people are already doing, but they need, they're not going to take on that little additional hard thing unless they really want to own their own content.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just don't really think about it that way. Or they think, yeah, I'd get around to it maybe eventually. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. It's not, people don't see the compelling reason right away.
Right. You know,
for some people they get having their name attached, and for some people, like, they don't want ads or something like that. But it seems like so many people grow up now where ads are so all over the place. It's not even, I mean, they know that ads are annoying and intrusive, but like, they're so used to it, maybe they don't even worry at the same level that, you know, I would worry if ads were on my content.
You know, here's the thing. How many years did you use a computer before you ever saw an ad of any kind on a computer screen?
Right.
It must have been a lot of years. And you now see more in one day than you did in the first, what, two decades of computer use?
Yeah, right? It's true.
I'm thinking maybe fake ads on the Commodore 64 version of Summer Games.
Sure. Okay.
Might have been it.
So, you know, I did have the idea. I've criticized myself for this. Back when NetNewsWire 1.0 was released, there was an RSS reader and a blog editor, which later became MarsEdit. But they were one product. They were one product for a reason. Well, for two reasons. One was because my competition was Radio Userland, and it had both of those things. But also, Dave's idea, which I thought was good, was that having one tool for reading and writing actually does make a certain amount of sense. And right now, if you use Twitter or Facebook, you have one tool for reading and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does make an awful lot of sense. Even though it was a crazy mishmash in NetNewsWire 1.0, still the idea is sound, I think.
And you kind of got back to that with Glassport, actually.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, so it's for better or for worse, that is, it is something that begs to be unified, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, indeed.
Daniel, have you ever thought about bringing back an RSS reader into Marsed?
No. However, I have thought about writing a clone of NetNewsWire 3. In my worst moments.
You wouldn't want to start with, I mean, you know, years have passed since that design. You might not want to do something very different, very modern. You know, something that recognizes the lessons we've learned from Twitter and Facebook. For instance, that people like having a pretty simple timeline rather than, you know, a big old folder structure and all the, you know, all the crazy complications that go with that.
I think I'm a simple person, Brent. I just like what you fed me with NetNewsWire 3. And it don't work so well no more.
Yeah, I believe that, yeah.
But it's interesting. Manton, responding to your question directly, I suffer all the problems with MarsEdit that Brent and Sheila suffered back years ago when they passed it on. It was it's a big old freaking weird hard project. And I think if there's anything I had to say that was the worst thing about MarsEdit is it doesn't leave a lot of room for ambition to expand the scope of the project, right? So it's like, wouldn't it be nice to be able to add something where you could also, like a common request I get is managing comments. And I'm like, you know, I could see MarsEdit being like a full service, like this is my powerhouse of managing my blog. But just getting it to be even like trying to capture the feature set of writing a blog is hard enough that I can't even indulge the thought of expanding it beyond that. So
I've got the new feature for you. Ready?
Yeah.
It goes back to that first version of NetNewsWire that had a third feature that Brent
didn't outliner.
It had a notepad outliner, which I loved. And it's a perfect fit for writing. And that did not get spun off into its own app, right?
So no, it didn't, yeah.
maybe a little under the table dealing here.
You really
is that code still available?
But you should probably use that outline view. Technically, I don't know. It's a good question. And nobody wants that code. Let me put it that way. Yeah. I would just
did
use
you
that
actually
as outline
think
view.
About? I can't remember. I know I was.
I did. I had a name for it. Yeah, I had a name.
Oh, you thought about having a separate app with it?
Yes, so it was going to be a moon icon, right, which would have fit in very well, and it was called Moonliner.
Moonliner, nice.
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that. Very cool.
Hey, is this a breaking news?
It is. I don't think I've ever said anything publicly.
Moonliner. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. Moonliner, yep. Yeah.
That's great.
Let me go back to MarsEdit before you continue. I know what features you need. MarsEdit, don't think of it as like what more blog management I can do. Think about the blogger's brain. What tools do they need? For instance, when I'm sitting there, I would love to be able to see my my bookmarks on Pinboard and my stuff in Instapaper, because there's a damn good chance that I want to blog about some of that stuff. I want to link to some of those things. And then I'm like, oh, well, if they were right here in MarsEdit, I could pull that up really fast, look through them, you know, and but they're not. Right. So it can be, you know, it can be just enough more of a pain that I blog less often than I would because it's, you know, it's so I want like the blogger's brain app.
Yeah, oh, that's good. That's good advice. And I realized that a big challenge for me is balancing how much I'm chasing emulating the web-based interfaces for these blogs versus how much I'm, you know, not how much I'm leading in what the like you say, what the blogger's brain thing is, because like a lot, as you know, probably the well, when you wrote MarsEdit, really there wasn't much in the web interfaces to chase or lead, but I think the sort of like long term advantage that MarsEdit has is for the people who like it. It's like it approaches things in a different way than the web interfaces do. And that's, I think that's the right approach. I think you're right that's like, cause one of the things that gets me down is like, oh, there's so much to catch up on. And to the extent that you sort of like make a different path, you're like, oh, I don't have to catch up on stuff. I just have to make a different path where, I offer things that they don't have.
Yeah, because the world's changed since Brent first wrote that. Before, he was competing with other, like, one-person companies, right? Now you're competing with huge, 100-person WordPress, whatever. Tumblr probably has hundreds of people. Right. I mean, you kind of, yeah, exactly. Square. I mean, you're kind of competing with those people in some ways, and they've got design teams and a bunch of engineers, so they can add all sorts of features to their web interface. So yeah, I like the idea of admitting like you can never match them totally. So have a kind of a more, kind of a different path and focus on other things that they can't do well because they don't have a native app.
Yeah, I'm going to get right on that, guys.
Well, you should. Yeah, you totally should.
One of the things that strikes me is, Brent, you mentioned that, actually, I can't remember. It was either Brent or Manton, one of you two fine gentlemen said, we have to get like regular people to actually care about owning their own domain. And how do we get them to that? And it struck me that one of the problems is people who choose to own their own domain are usually doing so in the service of some specific kind of like, I want to have a blog, or I want to have a company domain name, or I want to have a vanity site for my family. And they're sort of like edge cases, like where it's a lot of people you talk to, they're like, well, why would I need that? Because I have Facebook. Or why would I need that? Because I have my Tumblr. And I think in a weird way, like something like the about.me type of page that sort of takes on a larger, it aims to be more than just like this one like specific facet of your life. It's like, this is my center here. And like really the classic, like this is my homepage, right?
Yeah.
But these days, a lot of people don't think about like, this is my homepage. They think about like, well, this is my blog, or this is my Tumblr, or this is my this or that, and this is my photo page. But maybe the way to sort of like you were saying, Brent, like keep like, just like, you know, it's just like edge towards this, getting everybody to have more free speech and empowered and own their domain. Maybe the sort of sneaky way towards that is getting like everyday people to think, well, I just need a domain name like I need a phone number, right? Like that's the end goal. And right. You don't need a phone number to do business per se. You don't need a phone number to call your kid's school per se, or call your church, or be on call for emergency messages from the town or the phone tree. You need a phone number because it's like your basic entry to society. And maybe what we need to think about as three of us, and maybe what we need to inspire people listening to this show to think about and beyond, is what kind of service inspires people who don't even think of themselves as techie or as having a podcast to host or a blog to host. What kind of service of the internet can exist that makes you think, of course I have my own domain name. How else would people know how to get to my blank?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
That's a great point. 'Cause I would say email, except that's not how it's played out. People have no problem having a Gmail address forever.
Yeah.
Right.
They just don't really think that that's a problem. That's
totally normal. And email is not real-time interactive, which I think limits its ability to sort of serve the variety of things that a domain name can. Right? Like you can, yeah. I guess, it's funny you say that, and then I remember back like, well, email can be kind of real-time, but not really. Like you can't say, well, just because I have Manton@manton.org, if you ever want to check out what I'm doing, just go to Manton@manton.org. No, it's like it's too transactional, right?
Right. So what you're saying, I think, is that maybe the web needs a new type of thing. Is that what you're saying? Like not just a blog and not just a...
Yeah, I think so. Maybe, and I think the reason that about.me came to mind is because I always found those kinds of services a little distasteful, but I think there's something to them. That I found them distasteful because I think it felt like, again, another case of outsourcing your identity to some third-party hosting service. But the the idea that, like, you know, for example, I have Jalkut.com right now. That belongs to me, and it's this stale, weird site that just lists, like, I think my AIM address and my Twitter handle. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it should be more than that. And maybe if there was a service or not so much a service, but a convention for owning your own domain name. A convention for owning your own domain name that was not in the service of hosting a blog in particular or any of the other things that we host, you know, we have a domain name for. Maybe that would be like the entry point to say, like, well, of course I have a domain name. That's my, that's like my entry in the yellow pages.
So it's right? a kind of identity server.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right.
Gotcha. And it says who you are, how you want to be contacted or not be contacted, where you exist otherwise on the internet. And you own it in a way that even the least technical among us would want to own. Maybe that means like you need it to participate in government. I don't know. How does that work?
You have to have a URL or you can't vote.
Right. this sounds terrible, but you know, that's the,
because what we need is fewer people.
Yeah.
Right. Work, Daniel.
But that's the logical extreme on a practical level, you do need a phone number to participate in a lot of society. Right. And why?
I say we give everyone a 5% tax break. Who has
their own domain name? Yeah, yeah. All you have to do is host a Goatsy image on your domain name.
Well, I like, you're totally right. I mean, you kind of, when you talked about as a phone number, that's really hits to the heart of the problem. Because yeah, no one thinks I'm just not going to have a phone number. Like, unless you're a kid and you're not old enough to have your own cell phone or something. Like, no one says I'm just not going to have a phone. So we need to get to that point. And I'm trying to think how, I wonder if, I mean, it seems like there's established companies that have really dropped the ball that could help with this. For example, maybe when you get a phone number, you should also get a domain name. I mean, maybe AT&T should be like, yep, for an extra $1, you know, you can get a domain name. And I think maybe the price is also part of this. 'Cause I said that I thought domain names were kind of clunky and, you know, you have to renew them and stuff. They have, like, the .name domain name came out, I think, probably a few years ago. And the idea with that was a little more along these lines of you'd have your name, .name. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's a bunch of weird top-level domains now. But still, that's – I don't know. It feels like maybe one of those domain names should be free or something, like one of those top-level domains. Maybe this should be no cost, where there's no reason. If you don't want to pay for your own good domain name – you can get at least your name or company name or something for like basically no money. Like it should just be super easy to get a domain name.
Yeah. Well, now you're reminding me that when I first got my first domain name, it was back when I was a kid and it was when everybody had geographical names. So my first computer domain name was toast.santa-cruz.ca.us. And I believe that was free. And that was probably the effort of making the internet a free, because that was also before, remember this guys, like when they first allowed commerce on the internet?
Yeah.
That was like, oh my God, you can buy something. Like, oh, yeah, it's legal now to pass a credit card from one computer to another. And so, yeah, we're sort of trying to like edge ourselves back to this time when, oh yeah, the internet being such a free, open, distributed system, it was so, I mean, it was literally free. You just had to have somebody like put the row into the database for you.
I bet, I bet that was a city thing. Like Santa Cruz, I bet someone like saw the potential of the internet. And yeah, because I don't think, like, no, as far as I know, you couldn't just have a, you know, .tx.us in my case or something, you know.
Yeah.
Like that only government, like agencies agencies.
I think
those.
It was not governed by the, I don't think it was governed by the government. I think, we'll have to look this up, but I think it was independent of the government And I think it was administered only in that kind of geographical, hierarchical way as a convenience to make it at all manageable. But for instance, I think somebody, I think there was a .ca administrator who was a volunteer who was like, I like the internet. It's cool. I want everybody to have domain names. And hopefully 20 years from now, people won't be having podcasts lamenting the fact that nobody does. But, you know, at that time, you know, I grew up in Santa Cruz. That was a center of the internet, and no doubt. But I know there were lots of other geographic domain stuff. We'll have to do some Wikipedia searching and catch ourselves up on this. But there was something to it. I don't think it had to do with government. I think, for instance, I probably had my santacruz.ca.us domain computer on the internet before any Santa Cruz government office did, which I think tells you what you need to know. It's probably, that's probably true. I might be wrong, but I think that's probably true. And that was the example of the way the internet was designed being at that time more geographic. It was like, okay, if you have somebody who's willing to like step up and say, yep, I'm California. Okay. You get .ca, you know, and that was it.
Well, Daniel Will Mountain, thanks for coming on my podcast tonight.
Anytime.
It's been a blast having you as guest.
Yeah, I feel like I've been the guest, Brent, because I've been yapping. And one of the skills I want to attain as we do this more often is to let the guests speak more often. I apologize in advance, or not in advance, in the aftermath now, for all the hogging of the mic I've been doing. And I'm going to keep doing that right now for a little while.
No, you go on. Please, Daniel.
No, please.
No, absolutely. I didn't want to come on and just be the guy who talks the whole time. I wanted to come on with you guys, and I did, and that's cool. Absolutely awesome.
Well, it was great to have you on. You know, like Daniel said at the very beginning, when we started the podcast, we always thought we would have guests, and your name, I'm sure, it was the very, very beginning when we had talked, and now 160 episodes in, we finally have you on the show. So it's been great.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, I had to start a new podcast just to get Brent on the show. Yeah. You know?
And then you ran it into the ground.
Ran into the ground. One of these days I'm going to do a new podcast, new podcast just to interview Manton Reese.
I think that's a great idea. Hiatus. Bit splitting is on hiatus.
That's right. Hiatus.
It's not canceled. It's on hiatus.
Just like Macworld Expo.
Yeah.
All right. Well, once again, we are very happy to have had Brent Simmons here. It's an honor for us and added to a very short list of very honorable people who have been guests on the show. We want to thank our sponsors, Crashlytics. Again, you can learn more at crashlytics.com.
Yeah, and folks, don't forget the jobs board, jobs.corent.org. Check out the job listings there or post a job if you're looking to hire a iOS or Mac developer. So thanks again, Brent, for being on the show. If folks want to learn more about your stuff, I assume everyone who listens already subscribes to your blog and their favorite RSS reader. But just in case, what should they check out?
Go to inessential.com. That's my domain on the web. That's my blog.
And of course, VesperApp.co your latest indie project. And Omnigroup.com, right? That's the main place to go for one of the most prolific Mac software companies. And I would say definitely the most prolific to long lasting ratio Mac software companies we know and love. So.
And I'm working on OmniFocus for Mac, so you should probably buy that. That way,
you should probably buy that like 100 times.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so buy OmniFocus, put it on your OmniFocus to-do list to buy OmniFocus.
And I'm finally going to cross off that OmniFocus item: interview Brent Simmons for the second time.
Yep, there you go.
Because now we've done it. So but we hope to have you back, Brent. I think we should make a habit of this. It's fun. It's good. It freshens up our show. And of course, I'll practice not speaking as much, and Manton, well, you'll practice, I don't know.
Talking
me down.
Next time we'll have Brent on, he will talk the entire show. We'll just
it'll be a monologue. Yeah,
that'd be pretty good. I'd listen to that.
that'll be your alternative show to the record, the monologue.com.
I actually thought about doing a show that was just me, very quietly and soothingly talking into the microphone and putting people to sleep. I've been told that would be a hit. I don't know.
I'm sorry. What?
You were nodding off, weren't you? Yeah.
So many podcasts fall into the same kind of pattern. It got a couple co-hosts and the formula. I don't know. It would be nice to have more that are mixed up because it seems like, it's either a couple co-hosts or a round table. So I think a monologue, I think that would work. The only thing that comes to mind right now that kind of is close to that is David Smith's podcast.
Oh, sure.
Which is, 15 minutes, just him talking. It's kind of rare to have.
Yeah.